Writing of a structure at scale is hard. It's messy, it's complicated, and it has a tendency to go sideways in the middle of the night. Rather than talk about the idealized versions of things, we're going to talk about the rough edges. We're going to talk about what it's really like running infrastructure at scale. Welcome to the Real World DevOps Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Julian, editor and analyst for Monitoring Weekly and author of O'Reilly's Practical Monitoring. This episode is sponsored by the lovely folks at Influx Data. If you're listening to this podcast, you're probably also interested in better monitoring tools, and that's where Influx comes in. Personally, I'm a huge fan of their products, and I often recommend them to my own clients. You're probably familiar with their time series database, InfluxDB, but you may not be as familiar with their other tools. Telegraph for metrics collection from systems, Chronograph for visualization, and Capacitor for real-time streaming. All of this is available as open source, and they also have a hosted commercial version too. You can check all of this out at influxdata.com.
Hi folks, this is Mike Julian. I'm here with Dave Mango, former head of SRE for SolarWinds Cloud. Welcome to the show, Dave.
Thanks, Mike. It's great to be here.
So why don't you tell us a bit about yourself and what you've been up to lately?
Sure. I've recently, like you said, left SolarWinds Cloud. There I was running the global SRE organization. We'd started that with about two people at Librato and wind up growing that into multiple teams and multiple locations with certainly lots of products you've heard of. Before that, I was an architect in technical operations for Salesforce, working on their internal infrastructure, monitoring, automation, configuration management, all kinds of fun stuff like that. And I've been able to take a bunch of the experience of those two companies, plus lots of years of experience doing stuff before that, into a pretty fun conference talk that I gave a few weeks ago in Nashville at the Usenix LISA 18 conference. And I was talking about familiar smells I've detected in your systems engineering organization and how to fix them. And so it was really fun to be able to use a lot of the things that I've seen in my career and all the things I've seen as we try to mature engineering organizations, both operationally and all kinds of other fun DevOps ways, and be able to give a talk about that in a pretty, I guess you could say, controversial at times, but well accepted at other times, sort of venue.
It's always interesting when you start pointing out the smells in people's infrastructure, and the reactions are kind of all over the place. Like some people are like, yes, you're absolutely right. And other times it's like, no, please don't say that. Like, I'm not cool with you pointing out my flaws.
Yeah, I think the important thing is, you know, what I was trying to get across in the talk as a message is like, nobody's perfect. Like, we all have to get better. If I've seen those things in other organizations, there's a chance that I was involved in those things. It's not like, you know, I just kind of wandered in from Mars and I knew everything and everything was all good. Like, I've been growing throughout my career and I try to continue to keep growing throughout my career. And if people feel a little bit uncomfortable, I think that's good, right? That's right. A sign of growth if we're feeling uncomfortable. It's just, what do we do with that? If we get defensive, then we could double down on, you know, something that maybe we know in deep inside isn't really working for us, as opposed to, you know, maybe we go home and sleep on it and wake up the next day and say like, well, maybe there's a couple of things here that we could actually get some incremental improvement on. And that's ultimately how we make all the successful changes to our infrastructure.
I've had people come find me where they've taken my place at a previous job and they'll be like, why did you do this really dumb thing? And my answer is, yeah, it was really dumb. I'm sorry about that. Like, that was a technical smell that I created, and I'm really sorry.
Yeah, and
these are things that we did. Like, we didn't do them because they're great ideas. We did them for all sorts of reasons.
And also I think it's important, you know, with like John Allspaw's things that, it's easy to come back later and say, why did you do that? That was a bad idea. But, you know, we make the best decisions that we can with the information that we have at the time.
Absolutely.
It turns out that was a bad idea.
Yep. So this talk that you gave at Lisa, sadly I couldn't make it to Lisa to see it live, but you and I have been talking about this stuff for years off and on over coffee and lunch. And I did get to watch the talk after the recording went up. It's a fantastic talk, which we'll link in the show notes. But what I want to talk about with you here is, like, let's talk about that some more. Like, let's talk maybe the 2.0 version of this talk. Go a bit deeper, explore some of these, the points that you made a bit more, where with the conference talk, you're limited on time. We have a bit more time on this.
Yeah, there was a lot of content that I definitely cut out. And some of it was really, would you call it painful to drop it from the talk? I know that you recently gave some talks up in Oregon. Yep. And cutting down to the time that you have allotted sometimes can be
it's rough.
it could be like being told you should give up some beloved piece of infrastructure that you have your heart set on, and somebody gets up at a conference talk and says, yeah, you probably shouldn't be doing that.
Stephen King has a fantastic quote on that. Kill your darlings, kill your darlings, kill your darlings. I like, yep. It's the stuff you're most attached to. Yeah, you should probably cut it. But even then, like, it's so hard because it's such an interesting topic. It's a fascinating story. It's a really good point. Right. So it's hard to cut. So now that you said that, like, what are some of the stuff you had to cut from the talk?
Well, one of the things I really wanted to talk about was using revision control. And I know it sounds really silly, right? Especially for those of us who've attended all the DevOps days where the unicorns stand up and talk about this and that and whatever. And I'm certainly old enough to argue the finer points of CVS versus SVN versus Git. But, you know, I don't really care which you use. But one of the things that I was going to talk about in the talk about systems engineering is you make sure your stuff is in revision control, like, no matter what. And that really comes back to, like, the fundamentals of how we make change, right? Mm-hmm. So, if you're using configuration management for things, and certainly there's still a role for configuration management, despite, you know, the rise of containerization and all that other stuff, there's lots of things that we wouldn't want to run necessarily in a container. Or there's no advantage to it or whatever. But, one of the things when we were starting on this journey was, if we're going to make changes to production, don't go on the host and make changes, make the change in configuration management, and then go make the change in production, right? But we have mm-hmm. to use the code to do it. And so, going back to, like, the origins of the talk, one of the things I really try to make a central part of how we're supposed to examine these problems was this concept of crawl, walk, run, right? We don't have to jump to the end and, like, everything's like we're running Kubernetes in production tomorrow because we decided we wanted to do it today. We need to get our house in order to get to the point where that's something that we, you know, can do if that's indeed, like, what's best for the business, obviously. But I really like the idea of configuration management, or even configs, like, forget about configure, like, you know, the systems, but making sure those things are in revision control, because there's all kinds of stuff that can happen. And especially when we're firefighting and we're in the middle of a, you know, crisis, and we just want to get the things fixed quickly, like, this is one of our, you know, ways of making sure that we understood what we did. Well, did we change that file before we changed the other file, or did we change it after? I don't remember. Well, yep. Then how we get, you know, like, things get real confusing. And if you have this, like, practice of committing stuff to revision control, then it's all documented there for you. And, you know, I loved working with Peter Norton. That's, I guess, his handle on Twitter as well, because he was always like, we can roll it back. Because that's the great thing about configuration, you know, right. About revision control is, like,
we know what it looked like before.
Yeah. It's like, we can always roll it back. Like, that's, you know, that's not getting into the discussion of, like, whether there's true rollback of applications and whatever, but, like, the actual changes that we committed, that's why Git has a history. So right. Like, don't be afraid of it. Like, embrace it. That's really important.
I worked at a job where we had this problem. And everyone was like, we were all looking at how do we do this? How do we do it? Like, DevOps said we should do it. It has to be a full CI/CD pipeline or else it's not worth doing. I'm like, no, that's bullshit. Except no one in the company really knew Git except for me. and everyone was kind of uncomfortable with the idea of revision control in general. So I'm like, you know, we have RCS. Let's use RCS.
CO minus L.
So, you know, kicking it old school there, the granddaddy of version control. Yes, it sucks. Like, it's not a great version control system, but it worked. It solved the problem of version the files. And from there, we eventually moved into Git.
Better than none.
Exactly.
Yeah, so I kind of wanted to make a point of that. And then you kind of, like, took it to the natural extension, right? If we're going to do, like, crawl, walk, run, you know, crawl can be RCS. There's nothing wrong with that. Like, we're trying to develop some muscle memory here. Like, that's how you get started. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, maybe walking is using Git, or, you know, maybe walking is something else, like setting up a Jenkins server. And then, you know, maybe run is, you know, we've got Docker containers that are automatically being generated on code check-in and whatever. And, you know, even Docker, you have versions for the containers. But I thought that was a topic I really wanted to explore in the talk, and I never really, you know, time was a problem.
Right.
So I had to let it go.
Yeah, it's such a good topic. I think a lot of people take it for granted that, oh, of course everyone's doing this. And I don't think that's true. Like, even in companies that are doing this, there are places in the infrastructure where they're not doing it.
Yeah. And, you know, it's in the talk, like in the testing infrastructure section, right, where I kind of take an extreme position on runbooks that I don't really, you know, don't appreciate them. Not the remediation kind, but the, like, this is how we're going to make changes in production. But that flies so much in the face of doing revision control.
Right.
Because if my changes are done via me reading a Word document and doing whatever the computer tells me to do, that's not, you know, there's nothing there. Like, who knows? Like, we have 500 servers in production. What percentage of them have received the change? A bunch, yeah. You know, a bunch isn't a number. Like, that's not something we can quantify. And that's really important.
Somewhere between 1% and N percent.
Right.
It's like, yeah. Who knows?
And, you know, and that's, you know, like, people like you and me have done this a while. Like, that's where you're having outages.
Right. When these systems are mostly the same.
Yep. I guess Knight Capital is probably, like, the classic example of that one.
Right. Yeah. The Knight Capital story, for those not familiar, is they, why don't you tell that story? I think you probably know it better. You've been looking at this for a while. That's the one where they deployed a change too quickly or something like that.
I don't remember the details exactly. What I do remember is, I think there were, like, three servers, and two of them were configured one way and one was configured another.
Yeah. Yep.
And I don't remember the specifics beyond that, but that's, you know, it is not a surprise that there was a major problem when some of the infrastructure is one way and some of the infrastructure is another. And that's not to say, like, canarying is bad or anything like that, but, like, this isn't canarying. It's not intentional. Like, this is somewhere where we wound up. And in canarying, you have a very specific understanding of which machines are the canaries and which ones are not.
And we know how they were changed in a very specific way.
Yeah. And if I want to roll that back, I can do that. If I'm SSHing onto host and 207 out of my 500 hosts are configured one way and the rest are configured another, I don't know what that means. I don't know which of the canaries, which ones aren't. Like, it doesn't, it's impossible to reason about. And then when you have an outage, then you get the, like, people running off saying, like, well, I'm going to go check these 60 servers and I'm going to go check those and you check these. And I don't want to spend my time in an outage checking stuff.
Right.
Like, I want to have a very specific understanding of how things are configured.
Yep.
And that's why, you know, the automation comes in and the revision control comes in and all these other kinds of things, because, you know, testing in production is fine if are deliberately testing in production. You don't want to have testing in production to be a byproduct of a bad process.
Yeah, the testing in production is an interesting point. I think you and I probably hold a bit of a contrarian view. Personally, I think the whole testing in production argument is mostly bullshit. What do you think about that? Like, how do you view it? Run large scale systems yourself,
I think testing in production has a place, but testing in production is one of many things that are required. And being able to safely carry out tests in production is a really important capability. And, you know, we can do that with like dark launches. We can do that with things like feature flags. We can do things, you know, blue-green deployments, the canaries, all the stuff that we're talking about. That's great. I think the places where I get nervous when I see people having this discussion is like, you should test in production is sort of what, like the way that it comes out.
Right.
And you should have the ability to test in production, but testing in production is a really, really expensive place to test. And there's a lot of reasons for that. You know, one simple one would be, you know, if I have an outage in production, that's expensive, right? Mm-hmm. Now I've got all hands on deck. Everybody's stopping what they're doing. That affects, you know, the people who are responding. It affects my delivery of my software because, you know, we have a fire now and everything else comes to a stop. So, and then there's the reputation damage and then there's the customer damage. And there's a lot of ways that testing and production can be dangerous. But then, you know, it's expensive on that side. The other side of where it's expensive is to go back to like the, you know, Jez Humble and Dave Farley's continuous delivery book. It's way cheaper to fix things, you know, early in the development lifecycle or earlier, like let's call it like on the left side, than on the right side. And, you know, the reasons for that is I sit down, I write some code, I run my unit tests and, you know, whatever other tests I want to run, and maybe that becomes integration tests down the line or whatever. But if I get feedback 10 minutes later that says you broke something, okay, I can fix that. I just wrote the code 10 minutes ago. It's not a problem. Like, I'll sit down. Oh, yeah, I totally messed that up. All right, I'm going to change this. I'm going to change that. Okay, we're done. Boom. That's cheap because it's really, you know, we talk about fast feedback a lot in DevOps. Like, that's a really cheap fix. If I'm doing all my testing in production, well, okay, I wrote that code yesterday or the day before, or maybe, you know, depending on how fast your deployment, you know, pipeline is, you know, a week ago. Now I got to go back and, you know, refamiliarize myself with the code and what was I thinking back then and whatever. So it becomes really, it takes a lot more time to fix things. And yeah, I understand, you know, if I check something in and it creates a Docker container and that goes out like 20 minutes later, you know, maybe that I'm not going to have forgotten. Like, I can understand that argument. At the same time, like, do I really want to give my customers a bad experience? And saying like, oh, well, you should have all these things in place so they don't have a bad experience, it's fine. But, you know, that comes back to the old, like, in theory and practice are the same. In practice, they're not. Like, in theory, I can have all this stuff that's magic and it's awesome, but in the end, I'm going to have a production outage at some point.
Yep.
It's inevitable. So I'd much rather have those outages earlier in the process because they're not really outages. They're unit tests failing. There's the staging environment blowing up. There's whatever. And I think it's just a lot, you know, less expensive to be doing it that way.
You had a major point in your talk that staging is like prod. I think one of the, where I think the whole testing and prod thing is falling down or creating problems in my mind is that it's giving people license to not have a staging environment or to not invest in that area with the kind of backing of you cannot have a staging environment that fully replicates production, which I think for most people is not actually true. Like, you totally can. It's only at the very large scale, bigger than most companies are, that you can't do it.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's always going to be something special about production, and I don't think you can catch all those things. I agree with you in terms of it's a lot more manifest at scale, because you are not going to be running those kinds of numbers through the staging environment.
Right. And you can never really predict what customers are going to do with your systems.
Yeah, right. There can be all kinds of crazy inputs coming in from the internet that you could never have predicted. But at the same time, you know, I think one of the things I really try to drive home in the talk when I kept saying stages like prod, stages like prod, stages like prod, is that what I've seen people do is they get not so much lazy as they're trying to make compromises. And they're like, well, in staging, you know, we would like to do this, but let's just do it a different way just for staging. And I think you have to be extremely, extremely deliberate about making those kinds of choices. Mm-hmm. Because you really do want to catch things as far to the left as you possibly can. And staging is one of the best places to do that. And it's also, you know, I know when we're trying out new things, like that's a great environment for doing that. But the important part is that, you know, when I say stages like prod multiple times, it really has to be a representative test environment. And
right.
If you find that you're making these compromises so that it no longer becomes a representative test environment, that's when you're going to have trouble. And that's why you're going to be like, oh, well, let's just put it in production and find out, because we didn't spend the time on staging. And, you know, I talk about it in the Lisa talk. If you've ever seen like Gene Kim's, you know, general, like, how do we get better speech, like, you know, and then there's lots of variations on it. You know, one of the main points he drives home is high performing organizations can build representative test environments in a very short period of time. And if you can't build your staging environment because you handcrafted a bunch of stuff to be way different than production, you're not going to be a high performing team. Like, it's a major indicator. And so, you know, you can take that all the way back to, you know, the famous, what is it? You should be able to walk into your data center, pull a server out of the rack and throw it out the window.
Right.
And how long does it take for you to replace that server with an exact, you know, duplicate? I mean, thank God that's so much easier for us in the cloud now than it was in the data center.
I do not miss those days.
But, you know, it's still the point stands. Like, you have to be able to construct things. And, you know, it should be the same code. If I'm building something in staging, I'm building something in production. If it's not the same code, then what are you doing?
Right. Like, everything we're trying to do is make operating production safer. And staging, having a one-to-one staging environment, or as close to one-to-one as possible, makes production safer to operate. So it's not like we're trying to skip all the way and just like say, no staging, we can't have staging. Staging is a good thing. Sure, there's going to be some situations where you can't have a one-to-one. Like, I can't replicate Google scale traffic on a staging environment. It's not going to happen. But I can do some stuff there. Like, at least the infrastructure and the code can be the same.
Yeah, and sometimes the argument is financial, right? Well, we don't want to spend as much on the staging environment as we spend on production. Like, I think that's great. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. You definitely should not be spending as much on staging as you are in production. But like, one of the things I mentioned in the talk is like, if you're running on a C4 4X large in production, like maybe you run it on a C4 large.
Right.
Something smaller than that. Like, it doesn't, the point is it's called a representative test environment. It mm-hmm. doesn't have to be the exact same thing. And, you know, going back to like the Humble and Farley continuous delivery book again, you know, one of the points I really love in that book was the idea of, well, how much confidence do you want to have in what you're deploying to production? Because that's going to dictate how much you're going to spend on your test environments and how much money and how much time and all the other things. I remember working at a company and I was making an argument for infrastructure as code, like testing environments. And they said, well, how much money do you want to spend on this? And I said, how much, you know, confidence do you want to have? Because it's not up to me. Like, this is a business problem at this point. Like,
yeah.
If you want to have a high degree of confidence, we should spend more money on the testing environment. If you want to have an average or a lower amount of confidence, then let's spend less on it. It's not up to me to decide, like, what the right thing is. It's what's the business's tolerance for risk. And, you know, some businesses have a higher tolerance for risk than others. And if you're running, like, a really small startup and nobody cares that much about your product and you don't want to build a staging environment, then that's a business decision. And you're saying we're going to do all of our testing in production. That's a business decision. Like, that's okay. There's no one saying that you can't make that decision, but you obviously have a very high tolerance for risk in that environment. Mm-hmm. And I think as companies mature and they get more customers and more revenue that they want to protect, then their tolerance for risk goes down. And I think that's why when you look at like the Google SRE model with like the error budgets and, you know, SLOs and things like that, there's a very important lesson there that Google's trying to reinforce is like, you would think that we would have a very low appetite for risk, but we are very deliberate about the amount of risk that we're willing to take on. And we really do believe in having that risk. Like, that's actually important to us. And so we're going to make that a formal part of our process.
Yeah, I think that that is such a fantastic point because so many people look at SLOs and SLAs as a technical thing. And they look at staging environments mirroring production and like how many environments do you have? What do they look like? And they look at all these as technical decisions, but they're really not. You're completely right. It's a business decision. What's your appetite for risk? How much confidence do you want? Do you want to be 80% confident or 50% confident or 100% confident? Like, and all of that's going to cost more or less.
Yeah, I love actually that you're using real numbers like that because you recommended the How to Measure Anything book to me and I've been reading it and there's just a lot of stuff in that book about like being able to quantify things, like things that people would consider unquantifiable. So I love mm-hmm. that you're able to talk about your appetite for risk in terms of actual numbers. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah, that book is one of my favorite books. And like, I talk about it weekly just because there's like, how do you measure risk? How do you measure confidence? And like, those are hard problems and people would consider them to be unmeasurable, but they actually aren't. And this book talks about how you can do that.
Yeah, I like he does a little bit of the idea of this crawl, walk, run, right?
Yep, he absolutely does.
Start with something. Like everyone's trying to jump to the end. Oh, I've got a 58% tolerance for risk. Like, forget it. You can't just start there.
Right.
Start with something. And so I think that's really good. But that, you know, obviously with the things that we do in systems engineering or production or distributed systems, like it's not unique.
No.
There's lessons from other places to be taken there.
Right. Like even when building bridges and building skyscrapers and other, like an apartment building, basically everything is mostly known going in, but people are still in the civil engineering disciplines talking about levels of risk. And they're very upfront with, this is what we're going to do with a 90% error budget, essentially. Like, this is probably going to work, and we're confident to like 90% that it's going to be fine. And it's like, well, do you want 5% more? That's going to cost a lot more money.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's important for when we're talking about like building these staging environments.
Yeah, absolutely.
If it's really going to cost you 100% more to get that last 5%, then let's make some really deliberate choices.
Yep.
That's okay.
Does your revenue support that?
Right. There's no point in going out of business just to get that other 5%.
Right.
Like, that's not useful. Yeah, when you said testing the bridges, I just kept thinking of that Calvin and Hobbes when he says, "Dad, how do they decide what the weight limit is on the bridge?" Like, they just keep driving bigger and bigger trucks across it until it collapses, and then they rebuild it to the last part that they built the last truck. And then the mom's like, "If you don't know the answer, just say so."
I love that comic. We were talking before the call about boring technology, and there's a there was an article that sparked this a couple of years ago by, I forget his name. McFunley is, what's his name?
I think
name?
It's Dan McKinley. Is
Dan name. McKinley. Dan McKinley, and I'll link in the show notes. But the entire topic is choose boring technology.
Yeah, he's got a whole website that he did with his slides from a talk, and then he has an explanation of every slide next to it. It's really...
Oh, that's cool. I haven't seen that.
Yeah, it's really nice.
So when you're running these large-scale systems, how does that actually play out? Like, what do you... I know you believe firmly in this choose boring tech. So how does that actually look when you're making decisions?
Yeah, I believe in it because I've been burned by it, right? That's like that's mostly the way that people learn things is the hard way. But, you know, there's a couple of different things to that. Like the first one is the systems that we're working on are complex. And if they're not complex yet, and when I say complex, like I mean it like in the what's it called? Kinevin? I gave a talk on this. I can't remember it. In the Kinevin way. But like, this is a natural byproduct of working on any of these infrastructures for long enough is you're going to get complexity.
Right.
Whether you started out that way or not is irrelevant. If I start out with two servers and eventually, you know, or two cloud instances, whatever you want to call them, and eventually I have 500, like something happened along the way. We're not starting out with like our two things or whatever. And so, you know, I kind of say choose boring technology because complexity is an emergent property of all these things. You run anything long enough, you ship enough code. You know, if I have 2,000, you know, code ships, whether that's through Docker container or whatever, the environment's going to be more complex than it was when we started. So introducing complexity in to an environment that's already going to get complex is sort of, you know, it's a bad idea. It's a bad smell. It's a bad sign because we're going to get that for free. I don't have to do any extra work to try to make things more complex. That's going to happen. And so, you know, it comes back to, you know, even some of the stuff that you and I were talking about earlier, like when we talked about revision control, right, is if all the all the configs for app foo are under etc foo and all the configs for app bar are under, you know, etc bar, if I'm going to make like some new, you know, application called baz, make sure the config for that is under etc baz. Don't be like, oh, well, var lib baz seems like a good place now. Right. It sounds like silly, like when you put it out there like that, but like one of the principles of keeping this stuff as simple as we possibly can is there should be some intuition about what the right answer is. So if I'm an operator and it's 3 o'clock in the morning and I'm on the host and, you know, we deployed baz and I want to know where the configs are, I shouldn't be going to a documentation, you know, document and reading through it and being like, okay, where's the config section? Where's the section that tells me where the configs are for this?
Yep.
Like, no, like keep it simple right from the start. Follow patterns that people understand so that when it is the heat of the moment, they know where to go and they know how to do stuff. Because you don't want to be relying on magic. And that's a little bit more of what I was talking about in the talk in terms of like boring technology. But you know, that the magic stuff is what kills you. And that's where you have these, well, I don't really know what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody, I mean, I've been in, I don't know how many outages. I don't know what's happening is not an answer I want to hear. Or it's not something I want to say.
Yeah. Like,
and, you know, I've always obviously with your background in monitoring and things like that, like that's one of the things that we're trying to answer.
Yep.
We want to make sure that we're never in a situation where we say, I don't know what's happening.
Yeah, absolutely. We were talking about you have an Einstein quote that you're pretty fond of.
Yeah, I don't know if we have the actual one, because I think his actual one is a little bit more wordy, but the the one I've heard boiled down to is make things as simple as possible, but no simpler.
Yeah, and there's also a related quote by John Gull. He's a systems theorist and it was a pediatrician that got into systems theory. And people love to quote what he's saying, which is a complex system that works is invariably found to evolve from a simple system that worked. A complex system designed from scratch never works and cannot be patched up to make it work. You have to start over, beginning with a working simple system, which is a great quote when you're talking about systems architecture. But there's another bit that he goes on to say that people have kind of forgotten about, which is that a simpler system may or may not work. Like, if you were to rebuild a SolarWinds product today and try to make it simpler, you may not be able to. Like, you would probably end up with a pretty complex system because it just cannot be made simpler and still serve the customers. So complexity is not necessarily a bad thing. As you said, it's an emergent property. It's a good thing. It's going to happen.
Yeah, I think the important thing is, you know, is we need to learn from all the things that we're doing. So you're that the part of that quote that I kind of resonated with me is I was working somewhere where they had rebuilt their entire production stack, right? And not many people get an opportunity to do this, right?
Right.
That's, you know, it's pretty awesome, but, you know, they had a new VP come in. And he was a guy from Microsoft, and they wound up like rebuilding their whole production stack on Windows. They were using Java and Tomcat on Windows, but you know, they wound up rebuilding it. And I was talking to one of the systems engineers, and he said, "Well, obviously, you know, Microsoft is a better operating system and a better environment to do development on and run things on because our new environment has so many less problems than we used to have in our old environment where like things were, you know, breaking all the time and it was hard to get things done. And so obviously this is a superior technology." And I said, "Well, do you think that the reason that this new environment is better than your old environment is because the technology is better? Or do you think that you looked at all the things that you were having problems with and when you re-architected it, you made sure you architected all that stuff out of it, you probably have a lot simpler system now that runs a lot better because you knew all the things that you didn't like about your last environment." Oh, okay. Maybe it was that.
Right. Every time I've seen a company or a team move from one technology to another, like competing technologies.
Right.
And this is, I've seen this happen with config management over and over and over. Someone will have Salt, Ansible, Chef, Puppet. It doesn't even matter. Pick one. And they'll say, "All right, this is screwy. We're going to move because it's going to fix all of our problems." They go to one of the other three and everything is better. Except that happens in the other direction too. So how is it possible that two teams going from Chef to Puppet and Puppet to Chef improve their situation by going to the other tool? Like, that doesn't make any sense. So. Yeah. Maybe it's because they got the opportunity to start over, to make things simpler, to clean it up as best they could, and that's what made things better, not because the tool they were using.
Yeah, and that's why, you know, kind of what you and I are talking about, that's why keep it simpler, you know, keep it as simple as possible, but no simpler, you know, you choose boring technology, all that kind of stuff is so important because it's almost inevitable that you're going to wind up into that situation where you're like, "Oh my gosh, we have to throw out Puppet and rebuild everything on Chef."
Like, right.
It's almost an inevitability, right? Because we said the complexity is an emergent property of these systems. So if we can put that off for as long as possible, that's an important thing. And that makes our systems more operable and it makes them cheaper to run and it makes our time to recover faster and all those other great benefits that we get out of it because that's what we want to be doing with our time, right? We don't want to be spending our time doing endless rewrites from Chef to Puppet and back and forth. We want to be spending our time like operating our environment and making money. That's why we're in business. If, you know, if we're in a for-profit organization, that's what best serves our customers, not endlessly shooting ourselves in the foot and then trying to figure out all the ways to undo that.
I think it was Joel Spolsky made a comment some years ago that software gets more stable over time. And if you're constantly ripping out whatever your code is and replacing it with something completely different, you're actually introducing instability.
Yeah, that's interesting. considering, I guess, there's the argument from chaos engineering that like chaos engineering doesn't create problems, it exposes problems that already existed. So I'm trying to like wrap my head around how that kind of jives with that a little bit, because if my code is in production and it's been running there for a long time, we know that that latent bug or whatever can be there, but that's okay, right? Mm-hmm. It's only when that code path is exercised in that way that we actually have the problem. And so I guess it does work pretty well with Joel's idea, because we can use chaos engineering to be able to expose those things.
Right. And I mean, just even knowing that you have the bug is like, that's 90% of the battle right there.
Yeah. And you know, then it becomes a business question as to whether or not we want to do something about it.
Exactly. And so actually that's a great segue to another thing that you talked about in your talk was like, if you have this bug, if you know that you have the situation, then you actually have really two or three responses for it. One, you can do absolutely nothing about it. Two, you can fix it. Or three, you can kind of patch over it with a human response. And how this tends to take shape is a runbook. So rather than go fix it, or maybe in the interim while it's getting fixed and getting debugged and all that, you write up something like, this is how you handle this when this happens. You had some pretty interesting stuff to say about runbooks in the talk.
Yeah, the runbooks I was talking about in the talk were, what would you call them? Like the procedural runbooks,
mm-hmm.
As opposed to like, say, a remediation runbook or whatever. And so the procedural runbooks I have a big problem with, because I'm like a big fan of making computers work for me.
Sure.
Instead of me work for computers. I don't know why. It's just a thing I've picked up over the years.
That's weird.
But yeah, when I'm sitting down and there's a Word document or a Google document in front of me that's telling me what I should be typing, I kind of feel like the computer's telling me what to do. And I just kind of have a problem with that, like, you know, fundamentally. Sure. But also, you know, like we were talking about earlier, you know, that's a good way of causing an outage is
right.
There's things that happen. I talk about in the talk where people make decisions that you didn't expect and all kinds of other things, because you're leaving it up to people's judgment, and everybody's got their background and experiences that they bring to the table. Ordinarily, that's a really good thing. If I'm going to have like an SRE team or something like that, I want a lot of diversity. I want a lot of different opinions. I want a lot of different backgrounds. When people are making judgments about which file to edit, not interested. Like, mm-hmm. I don't want a lot of diversity. I don't want a lot of different ways of editing the file, or, well, we should use this convention or that convention. Like, I want no guesswork.
I want one convention. I want one location.
Right. I think, like, you know, to your point a little bit about remediation runbooks, like, I am not a fan of them. I am not as against them, I guess. It really depends on how they're implemented.
Sure.
In the case of a procedural runbook, I don't care how it's implemented. I'm against it. Like, you can come up to me with all the different arguments you want. I'm totally against it. I think it's a terrible idea. We definitely should not do that. The remediation runbooks that I've seen work well are not really runbooks as much as they're a guide to things that you should be looking at if this application is having trouble.
Mm-hmm.
So like, these are the important metrics. This is what this means. These are the downstream systems for this. These are the upstream systems for this. Like, it's all about context and understanding, right? Because ultimately, you know, the goal of all these tools or whatever is to empower the humans to do great work. And, you know, we're creative. We do all kinds of things. The more data we have, the more, you know, information that we can use to make these decisions. Like, I think that stuff is really important, and I think that's great. And, you know, certainly this isn't your idea or my idea. Like, AllSpa talks about this a lot in terms of, you know, what the tools are supposed to be doing for you. I think that the places where it starts to go off the rails a little bit in terms of remediation runbooks is when it starts to do those things like, if you see this, type this. If you see that, type that. If you see this, restart this thing. That's where I start to feel like it goes off the rails, because then it starts to become a lot more like that procedural thing. And literally, like, all you're doing now is you're giving, like, the people who are trying to fix the problem, like, one more thing to think about and one more thing to remember.
Right.
Because if it wasn't in the, if they read it in the run book, like, three times, right, then you can, the fourth time they have to fix this problem, which there's already problems with just that statement. But the fourth time they have to, they're like, oh, I know what I'm doing. I'll just go restart this thing over here. And like my goal for SREs that I'm working with is I don't want you to have a bunch of things in your head that you have to remember. Like that's a problem. And we've talked about this a lot in, you know, in systems, you know, in SRE on the teams. It's like, if you're telling me that the thing that's the solution here is that a sysadmin or an SRE has to remember some specific thing about this application at 3 o'clock in the morning, that's a fragile system. And I don't want to put my SREs in a situation where they have to remember stuff like that. I want them to be in a situation where they understand what they're doing and they have the tools that are necessary to, you know, get themselves out of that situation. But just like a human as a depository for minutiae, just that's just terrible. Like that's not a good place to be. And so I think like for the remediation run books, it's very dependent on how they're implemented. Now going back to what we said, like if you are in a situation where you're trying to solve that, fix that same problem, you know, for the fourth time, that goes back to one of the other things in the talk, which was don't fix problems, solve them.
Yep.
Because I've seen this, you know, way too many times where people think that their job is to restart the Tomcat server. And that's, no.
Yeah, it's like, no, your job is to make that so I never have to do that. So it's no longer a thing.
Right. And we talk a lot about in our SRE stuff about, you know, I don't want you to solve the same problem more than once.
Yeah, exactly.
Like if I've seen that problem, what am I going to do about it? And you know, the answer isn't always something that engineer can do all by themselves, but that's DevOps, right?
Yep.
I'm going to sit down with the teams, you know, who are responsible for that system or interact with that system, whether it's, you know, developers or DBAs or network engineers or whoever, and be like, what can we do so that we never see this problem again? And that's different than saying, what can we do so that if we see this problem again, we know what to do, right? I don't, if, you know, I don't, that for me is where things are, there's a problem.
Because,
you know, well, what are you going to do? Well, I'm going to restart Tomcat. Okay, well, now we have a solution. Great. And now, like, if I'm going to say we're going to measure MTTR, which I guess we're not supposed to measure the mean anymore, but if I'm trying to lower my time to recover, now it becomes a race. How fast can I get to the computer and restart Tomcat?
Yeah.
That's not a good situation to be in.
I once worked in a company that had a outsourced ops team. And this is like the lowest level of ops. Basically, they were on call. And like that's the only thing they did for us is tier one on call. And they had run books that they would do various things when they got various alarms, but the alarms were never very good. And the solutions were also never very good. So one time they call me and it's like 2 a.m. and they say, hey, this thing happened. And in my mind, I'm thinking, oh God, I know exactly what that is. And they did the wrong thing. And then I'm like, okay, what are you calling me for? Well, it said to push this button. So I pushed the button and the whole thing exploded. I'm like, okay. Did you know that it would explode when you push the button? Well, yeah, we've done this before. Well, why'd you push the button? Well, the run book said to.
Right. Yeah, my favorite for those was I worked for a company where the pager would go off, and then inevitably a minute later, the president of the company would call and say, what are you doing to fix this problem? And I was like, well, number one,
I was trying to fix the problem,
but now I'm talking to you. And number two, if you're going to call me every time the pager goes off, why do I need a pager? Why don't you just call me? Skip it.
Yep.
The run books can be really dangerous.
Yes.
And the outsourced ops thing is something we also talk about in the talk. And I think that's one of the things I was, you know, your story highlights it very well, is, you know, what are you gaining out of that? Like they, you know, their incentive is sort of like, don't bother Mike.
Right.
And that's about it. Like, other than that, like their incentive is to follow whatever it says in the run book, because who's going to fire them for saying I did what it said in the run book? They're not, exactly. I can't, as management, that's not a defensible position. Wait, they followed the instructions exactly, so you fired them? Like, no, that's not going to work.
Yeah.
and so you don't want to set up environments like that, or to use your, when you're talking about systems theorists, like, you don't want to set up your system like that.
Yeah.
Because the incentives are all wrong. That's a bad
feedback loop.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, that's why outsource ops can be so dangerous, is the, how do you get out of that situation? Like, who's going to be the driving factor to get out of that situation? Right.
No,
you,
one. Like, that's,
you said,
a,
like, hey, they said, hey, we restarted it, even though we knew it was going to blow up. Okay. Well, that was a bad idea, but what's the incentive to get out of there? Who's going to be the person that drives that change? Is it their manager? Like, when Mike goes back to their manager and says, hey, they did what it said in the run book and it blew up, so they probably shouldn't have done that. Like, you're not going to win that argument.
No.
And that manager will be like, well, give me better documentation. Right? That's kind of like going to be their answer, because they don't want to be in that situation either. And now it's on you to do that, because you don't want to be woken up for something dumb. And so now, like, you're feeling the pain, and that's going to be the only thing that changes anything. But what if that only happens like once every 6 months? Or once 8 months, or every year and a half? Like, when is Mike going to be like, well, what I really need to do is stop everything that I'm doing and go write up better documentation for people for something that happens once every 16 months.
Right.
I'm like, no way. That's never going to happen. That's never going to get prioritized.
Nicole Forsgren, in her research, in her State of DevOps research, found that, what was it, companies that used outsource or functional outsourcing in IT are 3.9 right. times more likely to be low performers.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I could definitely see that. In fact, I think it might be, I think the number might be a little low.
Yeah. And I think I agree with that 100%. And the research that Nicole has done is freaking outstanding.
Oh, yes.
Like, whatever. But I think, like, the thing I would be worried about when I hear that, and I, like I said, I totally agree with it, is people are like, well, we're low performing because we have outsourced ops or whatever, or we're more likely to be low performing. And I think, like, it's kind of goes back to what we were just saying. It's like those, it's sort of like a feedback loop. Like, one thing causes the other, right? It's low performers will choose to do outsourced ops, and then people who are outsourced ops will wind up being low performers. Like, I think that's, they both feed each other.
Yeah.
Because you're in that situation where, like, what's your incentive? Mike's incentive is not to, you know, fix the documentation for something that happens rarely. And their incentive is not to be creative thinkers, because that's not what they're being paid for. They're being paid for doing the thing that's in front of them. And so I think, like, the only way out of that situation to, like, to do our crawl, walk, run is, like, we need to change the incentives. And so maybe the right thing for that manager on that team, you know, of that team, is to say, like, hey, Mike, you know, we don't want to call you for no reason, and you don't want to get called for no reason, and these folks are just doing what it says. What can we do to change the scenario or change the situation so that this doesn't happen? Right. And this goes back a little bit to don't fix problems, solve them. Like, in that situation, the discussion shouldn't even be, Mike, can you help us with the documentation for this one specific thing? Right? Because that's fixing the problem. That's not solving the problem. The discussion should be, what can we do to change fundamentally the relationship that we have and what people's incentives are, so that we don't keep winding up in this situation? Because I don't want to keep coming back to you, Mike, and saying, can you fix this documentation? Can you fix that documentation? Because that doesn't get us anywhere. We need to change the relationship so that they're incentivized to say, like, hey, you know, we knew that this thing blew up the last time. Why did it blow up? Like, what would happen? You know, what got us into the situation? What are things that we can do to understand better why we're in the situation? What are the things we can do better to, like we just said before, to make it so that, like, we never see this thing again? I don't want to see the same problem twice.
Yeah, like that completely shifts the relationship from us versus them to us and them. Like, they're no longer someone outside the team, but they're not part of the team.
Right, and there's your DevOps in a nutshell.
Right. So on that note, it's been absolutely wonderful talking with you today. I like to have some sort of closing action. When people are trying to improve stuff, especially these smells, what's something that they could do today or this week to really help them improve? Like something concrete.
Yeah, I think, you know, my advice for that is always when we come back to crawl, walk, run, right? I was talking about in the talk at Lisa about, like, if you've ever read The Lean Startup name is escaping me. Anyways, if you ever read The Lean Startup, like, one of the things they talk about there is the MVP, right? And the MVP is the minimum viable product. And a lot of people really mess up what the MVP actually means. And they think that the minimum viable product is the, you know, the junkiest thing of whatever I can possibly develop that I can throw out there. And that's the minimum viable product. And because it's a viable product and it's minimum, right? But the real lesson for that book and with the MVP is it's the minimal thing that we can put out there and learn something from. If we're not learning anything from it, it's not the minimum viable product. And so, you know, what I talk to people about when they want to, you know, crawl, walk, run their way out of it is, what is the smallest change that I can make that I can learn something from? Right. And this is why, you know, especially when we have these discussions about, everybody wants Kubernetes, like that's what we're going to do. We're going to go full on K8, like from the start is like, okay, well, what kind of workloads do we want to run on Kubernetes? And what are the things that Kubernetes is going to bring to the table for us? And are these problems that we have? Because if they're not problems that we have, then let's go back to our choose boring technology idea. Like, don't run some, like, massively, you know, scalable distributed system when that's not a problem that we have, right? And then once we've, like, kind of thought about what are the things we want to do, how can we solve that, you know, this problem? What are the different ways we can do that? Then we talk about what is the first step that I can do that I can learn something from? Because one of the great lessons about Agile, right, is to not do Agile, but to be Agile. And in order to be Agile, I need to be able to respond to things that as they come. And, you know, this is why we don't do waterfall anymore, because if 4 months into a 6 month project, we discover that we're doing all the wrong thing, but waterfall says we should keep going, then we're just going to waste another 2 months of time and effort and money and everything. So forget it. We need to be agile. We need to be able to adjust. And so by doing this, like, smallest thing that we can bite off that we can learn something from, then I have the ability to say, hey, you know what? We thought we were going to need Kubernetes, but it turns out we did this other thing, and this is actually sending us down this completely different path that we did not expect that we were going to go down. But it turns out this is going to fit the problem that we have so much better than what we thought we were going to do, like right in the beginning when we were trying to jump from nothing to run. And so, you know, that's sort of my takeaway for people is, what's the smallest thing I can learn something from? Start there.
Yeah, that's fantastic advice. So where can people find out more about you and your work?
Certainly, you know, I'm available on Twitter. I'm Dave Mango on Twitter. If you are interested in a lot of these DevOps concepts that we talked about, I have a video course on Pack Publishing called Mastering DevOps. It's about 6 hours of listening to me talk about high-performing organizations. Certainly that's another great, you know, I'm a resource that I'm happy to have had the time and ability to put out there. And I think it goes, you know, a lot of the things that you and I have been talking about are kind of covered in that course as well.
Oh, yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining today. This has been a wonderful call.
Thanks, Mike. I really appreciate it. Thank you. It was fun.
Thanks for listening to the Real World DevOps Podcast. If you want to stay up to date on the latest episodes, you can find us at realworlddevops.com and on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever it is you get your podcasts. I'll see you in the next episode.
This has been a Humble Pod production. Stay humble.